So now we have some time for any questions or anything anyone would like to discuss or chat about. Please feel free.
Does it work? Yeah. Okay. Today the speech gave me a lot of answers, a lot of knowledge. I've read many books before, so it added to the knowledge I had. So like, I feel that rationally I know what brings suffering, what frees us from it, but concretely I don't know what to do yet about it. So meditation, I find it not boring but not pleasant. Not pleasant and interesting. So is that the only way?
Well, strangely enough, it's there's no real word in the Pali language, which the Buddha used himself, that corresponds directly with the word meditation. So, and this is why often the question is wrongly posed. What the word that the Buddha did use was a word that means cultivation or development. And so that's not just restricted to a particular exercise that like we were doing just now, but it corresponds to a whole way of living and a whole education or training of the way you live in the world, the way you relate to your family and the people around you and your workmates and society. Also, the way that you deal with your emotions and educating your the way you look at life and your values, and it's just a whole comprehensive system. This is why, taken out of context, just applying some particular meditation technique rarely has a really transformative effect, because it's not embedded in the whole overall kind of cultivation or education process which the Buddha laid down. So it's not that it's a waste of time. I mean, people who apply some meditation techniques to experience a certain amount of calm and a little bit more mental peace. But the Buddha, let's say that one traditional formulation is like generosity, precepts and cultivation. Dana, sila, bhavana. So a lot of you can see in Buddhist society, like Thailand, that of those three stages, it's the first one that's become most emphasized and developed. It's generosity, kindness, sharing. But that's in itself not, sometimes the meditators or the intellectuals can be a little bit dismissive of that side of things, but it's just so opening of the heart, and it's something which cultivates very positive emotions. And this relates somewhat to what I was saying just now about frames and how you look at yourself and who you are. And by giving and sharing, that sense of I am someone who shares, I am someone who gives, I'm someone who doesn't just hold on to the things I've got. That in itself is a very maturing kind of frame, which comes through through giving and through sharing. Precepts, taking on precepts as boundaries for conduct, but also as objects of mindfulness. So here again, this is kind of a very clear distinction between ideas of morality in Buddhism and in, say, theistic systems where we have, like Christianity and so on, we have idea of commandments and reward and punishment. Whereas in Buddhism, it's more the idea that we consciously take on certain boundaries and certain standards for our behavior. And constantly reminding ourselves of those boundaries keeps us grounded in the present moment. So the example I often give is, say, the precept not to take life. So that means when you take that precept in the ceremony that you may have participated in, then what you're actually saying is, I undertake to use the intention to refrain from killing as a means to train my conduct. That's what it actually means, you see. So in the case that a mosquito bites you or something, and your automatic condition reaction is just to swat it, then when you take that precept and it's in your mind, you see, it's in the forefront of your mind, then hopefully you stop and say, oh, what am I doing, you see. And that is the awakening of mindfulness with precept as an object. So in sitting with your eyes closed, your mind is your object. But in daily life, one of your objects is your precepts. So you're aware, oh no, this is against the precept, so you stop. And it's a moment of awakening, because now you have choice. Before it was just automatic, robotic kind of behavior. But now you say, do I really want to do this? Why? Are there alternatives? So choices appear the moment that you can stop and recognize what you're doing. And this is why I like this English word recognize, because you say recognize, you know, you're looking at it once more in a fresh way. So in daily life, this is why precepts, and you know, not just the kind of put yourself in a prison and you can't do this and you can't do that, but it's a way of bringing your mind back to the present moment in a very practical kind of way. And the cases in which you're actually considering killing or stealing or committing adultery, hopefully, you know, few and far between. But where this comes up particularly, with speech. So taking, the precept of not lying, not speaking harshly, not speaking crudely, not putting people down, not just going off in a very frivolous way. These are things which can help you very much to establish mindfulness. You know, it's hard enough with your eyes closed, but you know what it's like if you're in a room full of people and everybody's chattering, or you've got the phone coming. You know, how are you mindful like that? You can't be mindful of your breath. You can't do all these kind of special exercises. So what do? Well, you know, you have these standards for speech, which are little markers, so that even if you do lose your mindfulness a little bit, you know, then you're coming back to it quite soon. So that's something that's very useful in daily life, I think. And when we talk about speech, the doubt that often comes up is, well, what about white lies? You know, when you tell lies, but you're not meaning to hurt someone. It's not malicious. You don't want to hurt their feelings. You know, so do you like my dress? You know, what do you say? You know, and I said my new hairstyle and so on. But here the point is, rather than seeing it, you have a choice of lying and keeping somebody happy, or telling the truth and hurting their feelings. This is how you see it's a practice, because now the challenge is, how do you, one, tell the truth or not tell a lie, and two, avoid hurting that person's feelings. So that becomes a practice in itself, and initially it's difficult, but you get more and more skillful at it. So on those two levels, that developing that habit of giving and sharing, and using precepts as as objects of recollection, this supplements the sort of the other mindfulness practices and becomes something that you can start to feel more integrated into your daily life. In these afternoon sessions, we're not doing any walking meditation, but walking meditation is a very good practice in that. The way that I practice, or in our tradition, we're walking more or less at a normal pace, but your eyes are open and you're aware of what's going on. So it's a little bit harder to still the mind than when you're sitting still. But the kind of mindfulness and concentrate and calm that comes from that is much more easily integrated into daily life. And so, you know, back home, there are lots of times where you're walking up and down stairs or walking from one building to another building and walking along the road. And so if you have some experience of developing walking meditation, then you can start to make those periods little walking meditation periods. Or we tend to think, you know, divide, this is important and this is just kind of filler, you know, like you're doing something in this room and you've got something to do somewhere else, and in between is just sort of nothing time. But you can, if you reclaim those short periods, 2 or 3 minutes here and 2 or 3 minutes there, then you find it very refreshing, just coming back to yourself and establishing things. And one important concept, which, to borrow a modern psychological term, is it's state-specific thinking. And what that means is, if your mind is in a very agitated state, certain kinds of thoughts are just naturally grow in that kind of mental state, and you can't force yourself to think other kind, just as you couldn't force yourself to force fir trees or oaks or so on to grow in this kind of environment. It just doesn't work. But if you through mindfulness and your mind just starting to get a little bit more peaceful, that's not kind of an end in itself. What it means is different kinds of thoughts start to arise in your mind when your mind's more peaceful. And certain thoughts that used to arise when your mind's very agitated don't arise so much. And that's very, it's very important to notice that. So, you know, that the story about the man and the horse, those are the kinds of thoughts that arise when the mind is more calm and more peaceful. So it wasn't that, you know, that guy trained himself to think like that. I'm assuming it's just that his mind was at that level, that thoughts of the welfare of other people just started to well up naturally. But it's difficult, you know, whether you're a monk or you're living, you know, in Bangkok, you know, it's not an easy thing to do. But going back again to the talk, you know, when there are different ways of framing difficulty. You know, if you say, oh, it's difficult, but then you say, well, let's compare it with climbing a mountain. You know, if you had to choose between climbing Mount Intanon and climbing Mount Everest, you know, which would give you more satisfaction? I mean, I'd assume it would be Mount Everest. But you don't expect climbing Mount Everest to be as easy as Mount Intanon. I mean, that's the reason why it's more worth doing it, you see. So, you know, just looking at that in a different kind of way, it doesn't mean that it's less difficult, but your willingness to put up with that because you see the benefits of it, or the suffering that will arise if you don't do it, is what gives you the energy to apply yourself to it. You're welcome. I think this over there.
Yes, it's a quick question about whether there's a word in Pali that I know doesn't exist in English. We have words for orphans, so you lose your parents, and widow and widower when you lose your loved one. But we don't have a word for losing your children if you're a parent and you've lost your... So I was wondering whether there is a word for that state of having lost your child.
In Pali, I'm not actually a Pali scholar. I don't think there is, as far as I know, and I don't think there is in Thai. I don't know if any Thai person here can think of a word. But maybe that's, you know, a measure of how it's considered to be almost unthinkable or out of the natural order of things. And even though, as you know, in former times, everybody, you know, very few people would not lose at least one child before the age of 5. But, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point that there isn't a particular word for it. There's even a word in Thai for having 2 children in 1 calendar year. But not losing children. Anybody else? Yes.
Thank you, Anton, very much for your talk. Having just given birth, I took a lot of what you were saying today through the framework of that experience. What you said about mental pain versus physical pain. You can have the physical pain, but the mental pain doesn't necessarily have to contribute to suffering. That should be quiet. So I suppose my question is... I think women now in developed countries as well as developing countries are sort of seeing the process of childbirth as being the pain associated with it as something they have a right to not experiencing.
Yeah.
So I wonder to what extent mindfulness and the practice of meditation could be applied to the experience of childbirth. If you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I can't speak from personal experience here, of course, and I hesitate to, be too prescriptive for something like this because I know, the physical pain of giving birth is in many cases intense, and they're always going. There are always going to be cases where having cesarean section is medically necessary, of course, and just being mindful of the pain wouldn't be a good idea. But I think that it is, it is a topic worth discussing, for those women who do give birth naturally to, rather than monks really, to be saying, what the benefits are and why you think that that's a better idea than having birth painlessly. I don't know, what would you say to that if someone was to ask you, why go through the pain? What would be the value of it rather than having a painless operation? What would you say?
Well, I think what you said about having meaning or finding meaning in pain.
Yeah.
So I view the pain of childbirth as being purposeful.
Yeah.
There's a reason why you have it, and it's actually getting to your point about wholesome versus unwholesome choices. From my perspective, it seems that would be a wholesome choice in terms of the effect that any drugs or anything has on the baby.
Yeah.
So that's, I guess, what would be my response.
I once read a discussion of the phenomena in which meditators experience really chronic, almost hopeless cases of sleepiness in meditation, get to a certain sometimes people you may even have seen even just for a few seconds and they go off and just fall asleep in meditation. I mean, everybody experiences this to a certain extent, but this is really kind of extreme. And one study of this I saw years ago said that there was a correlation with children who've been born through cesarean section, and that at the moment of birth that they were affected by drugs and that the mother had taken during. But I'm not confident enough about that to teach anybody really. But it's just something that I remember reading once. I think it really all comes down to this: the attitude to pain, the very idea that certain kinds of discomfort or pain are noble, meaningful. And so on, and that's a concept that many people have rejected now, isn't it? And a lot of modern technology is devoted to reducing the cases in which you have to experience any discomfort. So I think that our willing, not necessarily our ability to tolerate discomfort, but our willingness to tolerate discomfort has been very compromised now. So,
right. Sacrifice and bliss.
Yes.
The connection between the two and how it runs very deeply throughout all cultures, whether you're here in Thailand or in Europe or in Borneo. The need to sacrifice in order to create for the next generation.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, there are certain things that just, you know, when you make sacrifices, there is just something that feels good about it, doesn't it? You know, when it's for something that you believe in and consider noble and good. Fun.
Thank you for your talk today. Coming back to pain, when you have a splitting headache or a migraine, how can you think it's going to be useful and meaningful? Deal with the pain, intense pain.
Yeah, you know, I'm not. I wasn't trying to say that everything can necessarily be seen as meaningful and as, you know, sometimes, you know, this overly, it's kind of what I would characterize as New Age. It's all a learning process, and it's all, you know, that sometimes, you know, that seems rather kind of phony to me, but. Sometimes, yeah, this is, you know, this is how it is right now. This is more Buddhist. Yeah, this is how it is right now. What's the best way to deal with this? So in any, with a physical difficulty, you know, one part of it is what is the best medicine to take? What's the best treatment for this? So you follow that treatment. But at the same time, what you don't want to be doing is just feeling sorry for yourself or getting upset and anxious and fearful and so on. So to be able to maintain your mind in a wholesome state rather than an unwholesome state. And there may be different ways of doing that. Some people find just contemplating the law of karma and saying, well, yeah, this is my karma, and sometimes just that, to feel a sense of acceptance. And because acceptance is really the key, I think, speaking and reading about people with serious illnesses, very pain, like for cancer and so on, that, you know, almost all of the cases that I've come across, people say the key point is with that sense of acceptance. Yes, it's like this. It's just like this. So I think that's the important thing. You know, with something like migraine, also keeping being observant of the conditions which lead up to attacks of migraine. You know, it may be completely out of the blue, but you may see that there may be some a time where you're particularly tense, where you have some problems or something like this, and if you can be sensitive to those conditions, maybe that you can help to prevent them reaching that level of that sort of intense pain of migraine. Yeah.
Thank you again. If I can ask a second question. You were talking about meaningfulness of pain. What would you say about balance, that if you have experienced extreme pain or seen people in extreme suffering, it then makes your normal day-to-day life, you put things into more perspective because you realize in the grand scheme of things, it's not as bad as having cancer or losing a loved one. So is there that side of the meaningfulness, not enduring the pain, but having that vision forward that there is a contrast between negative and positive
things? Yes. I mean, there is a practice some monks will pursue of sitting through pain. And this is quite an advanced practice, one I wouldn't recommend even to most monks, but some monks already have good meditation, will make a vow and sit from dusk through to dawn without moving. They will go through periods where the pain will increase in intensity until it's unbearable. But I haven't actually done this practice, so my teachers have told me that that there is a point where suddenly the pain dissolves and just completely disappears. And when that pain disappears, there's just incredible sense of bliss experience in the mind. And then after a certain while, that bliss will gradually diminish and the pain returns and will be even more intense, and it can go through 3 or 4 cycles of this throughout the night. This for an experienced meditator. Now why that's considered a good practice is not just sort of, macho kind of I can do this kind of thing, but monks who've done this say that it reduces the fear of death considerably, and also one's attitude to physical pain is never quite the same again. Even if you're not doing something quite as extreme as that, if you have had an experience of sitting through some pain, maybe you're just not able to escape from it, but then it reaches a crescendo and then it passes away, that experience is incredibly valuable to see that pain does have an end. You know, logically, or you just feel that as it's kind of ratcheting up, it's just going to keep on going, because the conditions, the illness or whatever that are providing the causes for that are still there, so why should the pain go away? But when it does reach a certain level and then dissolve, then when you experience pain again, you have that memory that it does have an end and that there's something, the other side of pain. And that is a wonderful thing to experience, and a wonderful memory in the mind. But yes, on a slightly or lower level, as you say, the experience of pain means that you can use that to say, well, compared with that, this is nothing. And that way of thinking is that you can use that as a sort of skillful means in all kinds of situations. Yeah, I tell you, I don't know how wholesome this is. This is a joke. it's about the husband's looking over his wife's shoulder, and she sees he's got his picture in her purse, and he's quite pleased with that. He says, "Oh, I see you've got my photo there." He said, "Oh, yes, I take it everywhere. It just helps me so much." And he says, "Well, oh, yes, really? Why is that?" He said, "Well, whenever I'm experiencing some difficult situation, I take out your picture. I think, well, if I can put up with him, I can put up with this." So I don't know whether that's called a skillful means or not. But it's a good job. Yes.
Thanks. You were talking earlier about reframing, and you used the example of the Chinese and how they would start with limited small steps to try and reframe the context in which they had these prisoners of war so that they could use them for whatever purpose they wanted to use them. A good example of sort of moving from small activity to bigger ones until you actually had some strong effect on the person's behavior and attitude. if you're in a situation where it's not as easy to control the activity or the behavior and eventually the attitude of the people that you want to try and help reframe the issue, how do you initiate that when the circumstances around that are not necessarily as easily under your control as they might be in the example that you give?
Yeah, well, assuming we're, you know, obviously we're talking about in a positive sense, yeah. I think the second example I gave showed that some very quite insignificant activities can also form that kind of seed for change. You know, in the case I gave, someone's just given a small 3x3 sign to stick in their window, and that encouraged them to see themselves as someone who has a sort of civic sense and is concerned for safety on the roads or beautification of the state and so on and so forth. And again, returning to something I said just now, in the traditional Buddhist way is giving and sharing. And I think that that has a very good effect on people. You know, when we go on alms round in northeast Thailand, you know, traditionally people would just put a little lump of sticky rice in your bowl. You know, it's not like in Bangkok or somewhere where people put rice and a curry and some sweets. In northeast Thailand, just maybe just a little lump of sticky rice, one for each monk. And so what that means is that even the poorest person in the village can afford, you know, a few lumps of sticky rice, and so can come out of their house in the morning and put food in the bowl and feel that they're contributing to the life and the practice of the monks, and that they belong, that they're part of this. And so that, so some forces are actually very small offering in terms of financially or materially, day by day, gives them this very positive sense of worth, and someone who is contributing to the monastery and feels a sense of relationship and identity with the monastery. And so I think that encouraging people to give and to do small acts of kindness and sharing is probably does more for people's self-framing or self-image than anything else. So people who have, you know, feel that they're hopeless, that they're bad people, to have them small acts of kindness for elders, for elderly people, just doing small things that for which they receive no real reward, but which make other people happy quite obviously, and even if in a small way. I think that's where to start, and there's just very, very simple, small acts of kindness. Talking about with pain, just reminded of me of something. I just went to Italy. I took a group of my lay supporters to offer catena at our branch monastery just outside Rome. And from there I went up to the Italian Alps, and there's a man, a lay supporter from Yasoton province, who's married an Italian lady, and they live up in the mountains there. And he's quite remarkable man for a Thai. As a young man, he cycled all over Thailand and down to Indonesia, and he had a kind of cycle tourist operation going. And so his wife was one of his clients, I think. And anyway, he went to live in the Italian Alps at the age of 30, And astounded people there with the fact that within quite a short time he became an expert skier in all kinds of different disciplines. And he was telling me that mostly people that ski, they tend to be very good in one discipline and not in the other. So they, you know, how could this guy from Southeast Asia come and suddenly do all these things? So people would come to see him, and so he started to teach them about Buddhist meditation and practice. And he started to receive invitations to go and give public talks in Milan and Turin and places like that. But he said he couldn't do that because if somebody wanted to come to ask him about Dhamma personally, he'd be happy to share whatever he wanted to know. But to exchange Dhamma for money would be immoral. He wouldn't want to do that. But what I wanted to share with you was that he has two children, a son and a daughter, and the daughter is a champion skier in the whole of that part of the Alps. But he was telling me how he raised his children. And he said, the principle I've used is teaching them to look at their feelings. So I said, well, how exactly do you do that? And he said, I'll give you an example. Say, like when children are sitting at the table and they get peckish and they want to eat something, I tell them before they get up and go to the fridge or take something off the table, they should just sit and look at their hunger for a few seconds and just see what it's like. And I teach them that with all their feelings, like when they're skiing and they feel tired and they want to stop and so on. And the story I really liked, he took his son mountaineering. And they were climbing up somewhere, so it must have been very steep. And of course, his son froze, you know, and that you can't go up and you can't go down. He says, Dad, I can't, I'm frightened. And so his dad said, well, look at the fear. I can't, I'm too frightened. What's it like? Tell me what your fear's like. And he says, it's kind of black and nasty. And I said, well, look at that black nastiness. Just look at that. Look at that blackness. And his son was quiet for a few seconds. He says, Dad, it's changing. It's turning gray. Dad, it's dissolving. Dad, it's gone away. And he said after that they could climb up the mountain. I was very impressed at that way of teaching children. There was a word that became popular for a short time, and it sort of disappeared now, and I thought it was such a good word. But that's the word Moorish. People don't usually use that, do they? Yeah, maybe because it sounds like North African, but it's... But, you know that's really... You know, when you get something and there's just... You want more. But I don't know what the equivalent for... Well, that's sort of one kind of craving. But the other kind of craving, which is not lessish, but it's just, I don't want this. You know, I don't need this. So I don't want this right now. And that's really, you know, what is the problem with pain and discomfort. Almost immediately, you know, there's a sense, I don't want this. This is not right. You know, this is... And we find physical pain threatening... It threatens who we are. It's not just it's painful, but it undermines the sense of who we are, which is why we want to get rid of it so quickly. So training yourself just to be with that consciously, just to bear with it for a while, doesn't mean just to, you know, grit your teeth forever, but just for teaching a child, or just for a while, not immediately reacting against discomfort. But being with it and seeing, it's not so frightening at all. And then, you may decide, yes, this, I don't want to go anywhere further with this. But it's not just that immediate reaction. And my teacher would teach us monks. He said, when you're sitting meditation, you think, okay, that's enough, time to get up. He says, sit for 5 more minutes. Or when you're walking meditation, that feels just about right. He said, just walk a bit further. And that's a really good habit to develop also. Yeah.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Yeah.
Of course, my mind is swimming with questions, but I'll try to keep it to one. It's very similar to the previous question. I've been thinking throughout the talk today of the context of the framework that we live in and work in and the societies we're part of, and that mindfulness is usually not part of those contexts, those frameworks. It's a struggle to incorporate that, and often it's not responding to a situation, say, in the office or with family or whatever, is not rewarded if it's necessarily mindful, even though it might be the wholesome approach. And I'm wondering, in addition to the idea of introducing that in small ways, is there any advice you have on introducing the idea of mindfulness itself? The kind of work I do, I look at global problems in many respects, and some of them seem impossible to solve, and that we're quickly going downhill.
Yeah.
Not just in small, in small communities, but on a very large scale. And time is running out. And I don't want to sound like a doomsday, like that's a doomsday scenario, but there's some very serious problems that a more aware consciousness shared among people more broadly is really essential. Now, there's still a lot of drivers that push for greed and wealth and fear as well, and there are forces that seem to be very difficult to resist.
Yes, I think this is one of the challenges for anyone working in your kind of field is not to just fall into states of despair or at least to be too discouraged. And again, I think taking the model from looking at your breath, one breath at a time and one day at a time and one problem at a time, because that's all you can do anyway. That things are not sure and can never be too sure. Whatever happens, it's not going to be how we think it's going to happen. But the way of dealing with problems generally, that's given to us by Buddhism. We talk about three different areas. Let's say one is the area of conduct, and here the view would be that you have to have just things like transparency, rules, regulations, laws. Which are going to enforce particular kinds of behavior. And that's based on the principle that, what I've seen, I've been living in villages out in the middle of nowhere, and you can have 99 families who are all quite supportive of keeping the forest and saving the wildlife, and you only need one family with a chainsaw. And they can negate 99 families who have intelligent and thoughtful attitudes to nature. So no matter how much you can promote these kinds of values of intelligent reflection and sensitivity and so on, it's not enough. You also have to have the laws and the rules and the regulations and the lack of corruption to handle even if it's only 1 in 100 who are going to be completely impervious to that. But just having whether it's laws and police forces and militias and all these kinds of things alone is obviously not enough. So the second level is on the emotional level, and this is where trying to promote these kinds of positive values and finding ways to reduce the power of the negative emotions. So in that sense, let's say in the case of conservation of nature. Now, if you take kids out into the forest when they're small and you go camping and you point out the flowers and the birds and so on, and the kids just feel they love to be out in the forest, then that stays with them throughout their life. So this is not necessarily explaining to them the reasons why you should care for nature and so on, but it's starting off with developing this emotional support and teaching people how to deal with greed and anger and finding skillful means to deal with emotions. I think this is something which has to be embedded in education system, which is why I'm interested particularly at the moment in nursery and primary school education to help children to develop skills to deal with the inner causes of the destructive behavior towards the environment and so on and so forth, rather than waiting till they're already in their teens, already, you know, completely bombarded with hormones and all kinds of stuff going on. So there's the emotional side, and then there's the wisdom side, where you're giving people reasons and encouraging them to look clearly and seeing why this kind of behavior is destructive, and this kind of behavior is positive and valuable. So we're saying that on one level, it's like the framing that I'm talking about, the way, the whole, what we call in Buddhism, right view, right understanding. Then there's the emotional side, and then there's, as I say, at the same time, then there has to be this further level and the outer level of laws and regulations and conventions and so on, because there's always going to be people who are not reached by that more subtle approach, and that they need to, there needs to be some kind of restraint on that level. But, we can just do what we can, don't we? Each one of us, and anything else, anybody? Okay, if that's the...